Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Here with Lisa Arnone, my assistant, researcher, therapist herself. We've been doing some research on trying to figure out what this model of psychology is, what it does, how it works. And we've been doing a series called The Psychology for Therapists, which I'm not going to bother explaining very much, but it basically means if you were teaching professionals, how would it be? And that's the way most of you have been listening. And it seems that your response to it has been very positive. So finally, yesterday we talked about learning to ask the right questions. Like, the right question is you could go to a counselor or your priest or a therapist or your friend, and you could say, why does he treat me so badly? Now, that's one question. But if you reduce that question, you could ask the question to, well, why do I get treated so badly? And then if you were to take that question and reduce that question again, let's say you just boiled it a little bit and took out the steam and made a roux, you'd say, okay, why do I get myself in these situations? And what is it about this that's appealing to me? Those are going down a series of layers that very few people are willing to do. Because most people just want to blame the other guy, and they don't want to see. So what happens over time, and many of you, most of you have taken this journey, is you get smart enough to say, hey, it's not their fault. I'm the engineer. I'm the one constructing this. And you also learn that this is not because you're a bad person, but because when you were a kid a long time ago, you learned that a strategy of adjustment of some kind worked better than being, quote, completely honest with what you felt, meaning telling people what you felt, because it wasn't convenient. Today, we're going to look at the idea, this basic idea, this concept of where do you go if you're not being false, if you're not being fake, if you're not being a performer. Where do you go? What's it like? What's underneath it all? Let's take the idea of pain. Let's say emotional pain. Let's say depression, okay? You go in for depression and you say you go to a therapist or somebody. What's the idea? Is the idea to remove the pain? Most people who go to therapy want to have pain removed. Now, I say therapy, I mean you could go to your bartender and decide to tell your bartender and you want to have the pain removed. You know, your bartender's got medicine and it'll help you, and he's got a soft shoulder. Or you could be talking to your best friend. So when I say therapy, I mean some kind of exchange with another human to try to relieve a situation. Is the idea to remove the acute pain, right? Acute is very important. Because if it's acute, that means it's in response to something that recently happened, and you identify it as acute, but you don't see it as a series of pains that are the same over and over and over again. So if, let's say someone dies, and you have this acute pain, this grief, this loss, and you just want the pain to go away. So you want to cry on somebody's shoulder because you want to feel safe again in life. And that may be acute. That may be the only thing time you ever go through that. So that could be the acute pain. Now, or is the idea that you identify that you've been in this pain before, and what you want is to remove the pain so that it doesn't come back? See, in this case, you're saying, like, let's say in the first case. In the first case, if you went to a doctor and you said, I got a pain in my toe. Right, and the doctor says, "Well, here, take this pill, and you won't feel the pain in your toe." And you say, "Oh, okay." And you take the pill, and it takes away the pain in your toe, and that's good. And then your toe gets better, and that was the end of that pain. In the second case, you want to remove this pain in your toe so that it doesn't come back. So if the source of it was elsewhere, you want to do whatever kind of work may be necessary to get rid of this. In some cases, it's surgery. In some cases, it's a deeper intervention. Some cases, it's change of diet. Because you want to make sure the pain doesn't come back. Because it's chronic, because you've had it more than once. So now think of yourself emotionally. Think about a problem that you have in life. Think about you get very nervous when people look at you, or you get nervous when people are judging you, or you get over-concerned about people's reactions to you. And you get very worried about it, right? So now your pain number one is, oh, I get so worried when my boss judges me, right? It makes me very nervous. I can't sleep at night. Pain number two, that's one. Help me get rid of that. Change your job. Okay? That's easy enough. Pain number two, I always feel this way with a boss. Well, we got to change something here. Maybe it's you got to work without a boss. Maybe you've got to, you know, do something different. Step number three, or approach number three, would be you got to get to the bottom of the pain so that you can discover the true source, because it helps you find out what the pain is telling you about the integrity of the entire system. Let me say that to you again. You want to get to the source because you figure, and in this case I use a pain in the toe, because it may be diabetes. You want to know, what is this pain telling me? So I don't want to numb the pain, and I don't want to surgically remove the pain. I want to find out what this pain is about to check out the integrity of my entire being. Depression. I'm depressed. I don't want to just get rid of the depression, because you could take an antidepressant medication. Boom, you're out of it. Okay? It won't come back as long as you keep taking the medication, maybe. Or number two, depression. Depression is so bad that I've got to go through some therapy to kind of see what's really going on and uncover it and deal with it. Or number three, I want to see what this is about and what it says about my whole life. This is Armand DeMille with Lisa Arnone. We're here with you with The Positive Mind, trying to bring you the idea, the concept of why people seek each other out. They seek each other out, and they seek out therapists because they try to get to some level. And here's the question I have. Is there, underneath it all, what's the idea? Is the idea to strip away all of these artificial selves so that a real self could emerge? That's what the therapists say. That's what they all say. They say, the real self will come up. The authentic self will come up if you take away all these artificial selves. I'm not so sure. No, I'm not sure at all, actually. I present a question to that very belief system, because I'm not sure that that's correct. But, sometimes you live a life that is so shrouded in falsehood that you just fake all the time. I have one friend who smiles all the time. Everybody talks about her smile. They say, oh, she has such a wonderful smile. She's such a good person. The person who knows her the best says she's vicious. And he's seen her viciousness. She's actually hit him and screamed at him and done things, but nobody knows this about her. Her own children don't know that she ever gets angry. So what a good mask. What a successful mask. And the mask is behind this smile. This kind of smile that you see, that you say, oh, how could anybody with that kind of smile have anything wrong? Well, the smile is a mask. And it's such an effective mask that it makes you not see any of the pain. Huh. You know anybody like that? So I remember somebody who met this person and said, nobody can smile that much. Nobody's that happy. So I don't believe her in the first place. Interesting. Doesn't make her wrong. It's just our defense. This is what she learned to do. Let's say she learned to growl instead. Let's say you're a child and you realize that you're like Clint Eastwood, and you walk around and you, Just everything you see. You give it a growl. Well, that'll keep people at bay. Or you can smile. And that'll keep people at bay. Because they'll hide and they'll just smile back at your pearly whites and they won't challenge you. And they won't get angry at you. And you'll keep your distance. How much of ourselves do we hide? And what's it like when you get tired of it? What's it like when you fall under the fatigue of your mask? What's it like when you turn around and you say, oh, please, please stop believing what I'm giving you. Stop believing what I'm showing you. Stop believing this. In fact, it brought me back, the thought of this brought me back to an old WBAI recording, which has to do with Roscoe, a hero of BAI. And this is a piece by Roscoe, which is very, very touching. Many of you are going to associate with it. Of course, many of the men will, if you keep the radio on that long. Do we need to dance first? This is it's a heavy piece, but very, very worthwhile.
But don't be fooled by me. Don't be fooled by the face I wear, for I wear a thousand masks. Masks that I'm afraid to take off, and none of them are me. Pretending is an art that's second nature with me, but don't be fooled. For God's sake, don't be fooled. I give the impression that I am secure, that all is sunny and unruffled with me, within as well as without. That confidence is my name and coolness my game. That the water is calm and I'm in command. And that I need no one. But don't believe me. For God's sake, don't believe me. My surface may seem smooth, but my surface is my mask. Beneath this lies no complacence. Beneath dwells the real me in confusion, in fear, and aloneness. But I hide this. I don't want anyone to know it. I panic at the thought of my weakness and fear of being exposed. And that's why I frantically create a mask to hide behind. A nonchalant, sophisticated facade to help me pretend, to shield me from the glance that knows. But such a glance is precisely my salvation. My only salvation, and I know it. That is, if it's followed by acceptance, if it's followed by love, it is the only thing that will assure me of what I can't assure myself, that I am worth something. But I don't tell you this. I don't dare. I'm afraid to. I'm afraid your glance will not be followed by acceptance and love. I'm afraid that you'll think less of me, that you'll laugh at me, and your laugh will kill me. I'm afraid that deep down I'm nothing, that I'm no good, and that you'll see this and reject me. So, I play my game, my desperate game, with a facade of assurance without and a trembling child within. And so begins the parade of masks, and my life becomes a front. I idly chatter to you in the suave tones of surface talk. I tell you everything that is really nothing and nothing of what's really everything, of what's crying within me. So when I'm going through my routine, don't be fooled by what I'm saying. What I'd like to be able to say, what for survival I need to say, but what I cannot say. I dislike hiding honestly. I dislike the superficial game I'm playing, the phony game. I'd like to be spontaneous and genuine and me, but you've got to help me. You've got to hold out your hand even when that's the last thing I seem to want. You can call me into aliveness. Each time you're kind and gentle and encouraging. Each time you try to understand because you really care, my heart begins to grow wings. Very small wings. Very feeble wings. But wings. With your sensitivity and sympathy and your power of understanding, you can breathe life into me. I want you to know that. I want you to know how important you are to me. Don't pass me by. Please don't pass me by.
Now you're listening to Roscoe. Let's just take a moment and let that digest. And here's a little something for your digestive. I'm just changing the mood for a moment, heavy as that was. You know what you're listening to, which is fun. When I got my hands on a bass. And somebody taught me how to play a bass, an electric bass. And so I made this recording. And it's all I could do was that what you're hearing here. I couldn't do anything more than this. But I practiced it and it was fun. This is Armando Mill with you with the Positive Mind. So there's the question we have. And the part about that the Roscoe piece that I really had a little objection to, but I didn't want to cut off, is the part about only you can make me whole. Only you can do this to me. That's, you know, that's part of the myth that we like to pass on. And that just passes on his illness, you know. He's saying, look, I'm a real wreck. He says, I can't really get past myself. I'm a phony, but only you can save me. Well, that's an alcoholic's song. You know, that's the song of most addicted people. They're saying, only you are my savior. However, the rest of it, the essence of it, is spectacular. Armando Mill with you with a positive mind. We're going to be taking your calls a little later, so here's the question. The question is, what is the real self all about? Now, let's go to the Enneagram for a moment. I go to the Enneagram because the Enneagram is, to me, one of the great sources of intelligence. The Enneagram, spelt in a funny way, E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M, in my interpretation, and others disagree with me, was something that the Sufis, who are this European people, brought to, you know, it was a way of worshiping God, Sufism. And they asked the following question. They said, how can we get people to come to church to worship God? Whatever the church was and whatever they called God. It could have been Allah, it could have been Jehovah, it could have been anything, whatever the Sufi God is. And they said, well, we'll try, why don't we have a night when we have bingo course, they didn't play bingo, but they said a night of gambling. They didn't even say that, but they said, we'll get all the people who like to gamble, and therefore that will attract them to come to church. Well, that's a good idea. But then somebody said, Mary Sufi said to Joe Sufi, but what if they don't like to gamble? Why don't we have a pie night? Okay, we'll have a pie night where everybody brings a pie and we'll have some food. And then somebody else came along and said, well, what if they don't like pies and they don't want that? Why don't we have another night where everybody paints a picture? Okay, well, now we'll have a picture night and a pie night. And they said, how many types of people are there? How many different nights do we have to have? And the Sufis determined that there were 9 types. And these 9 types were what later became the understanding of the Enneagram, E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M, which is what I use as one of my frames of reference. I do not use it as treatment. I do it as understanding. Now, what's important about the 9 types? What's important about it is this is how we got through. When you're born or when you're a child or even before you're born, according to the Sufis, this thing happens to you where you, in some way, are separated from your existential God self. Before you're born, you're part of the universe. Then you have to come down to this earth. And according to nurture and nature, we're going to tell you, we're going to give you a way of getting through life. So if you're an older child, for example, they figured out one of the good things, I mean, they didn't figure out, but whoever puts this all together in the universe, will have the older child be somebody who serves his parents. That makes sense. Because at first you're the only child, right, for a while, and you get all this favorite status. And then somebody else is born, and you say, well, how did I lose my favorite status? How do I regain my favorite status? And that's by becoming the surrogate parent to the new baby. So older children tend to be surrogate parents. And this way they get their father's and mother's love, because that seems to be what it's all about. It seems to be all about trying to garner the love and protection of the elders. So one way you do that, and how do you bring up children, is you could become a perfectionist. Many elder children are perfectionists. A perfectionist knows the answer to life. They know the answers. They know exactly how things work. They can tell you, they could line up the ducks in perfect order. They become preachers eventually. They become very good at preaching in front of churches, you know, at churches, and they always tell you what's right. They could become nutritionists who are always telling you this is the only way to live. You got to make sure you have this. And they tell you the perfect way of being. So that's one adjustment. Our question as we go through these different types is, what would happen if you gave up this position? What if you're a perfectionist who no longer had to be a perfectionist? What if you're a perfectionist who could make mistakes? See, the basis of the perfectionist is that the perfectionist perceives that there is something wrong. They are afraid that there is something wrong with them, something imperfect in them. So they look for the imperfection in other people. See, so it's this practice of making perfect. And I'm sure you know people like that. You know, if you go over to their house and you have a glass, they have the coaster that goes right under the glass immediately, you know, that they wipe every surface clean. And it's like, everything is perfect. The perfectionist. What would happen if a perfectionist took the pressure off their being a perfectionist? What would they be like? That's part of the therapeutic question that we're asking today. If a person comes to you with a compulsive way of being, and that compulsive way of being leads to an unhappiness, the question we have to ask is, what would happen if you didn't have that way of being? Which goes to Lisa's question that you had about the defenses, right, Lisa?
Yes. When you're talking about these masks, I'm thinking about defenses and wonder what your perception of is, if they're equivalent.
Well, the audience doesn't know what a defense is, so when you say defenses.
So a defense meaning basically the coping style, the coping skills that we develop in response to deficits, injuries, things that happened to us in the past that just become part of how we deal with the world. I'll never be able to trust anyone because I had that experience over and over as a child. So I have a defense about not trusting. I defend myself when I have to trust somebody.
So the Enneagram is a style, not necessarily a defense, but people in different parts of the Enneagram employ different defenses to protect their position. And I think it's the same question you're asking. What happens if you don't have the defenses? Mm-hmm. You know, what if you go in somewhere and you don't have the defenses? Let's look at another one of the Enneagram types. Another one of the Enneagram types is the giver, the compulsive giver. Compulsive giver is somebody who is a caretaker who always gives. Now, the secret about the giving is they give to get. They want to get loved. So they're not just giving and they're not just nice. They want the love in return. Question would become, what would happen if that person didn't give? Now, this is an assumption that a therapist would look at and say, you've got to stop giving. Well, no, you know, the smarter you get at this business, the more you realize that maybe there is no alternative. Maybe if the person doesn't have this, they have nothing. If you strip away a person's way of being, is the assumption that you're going to find an authentic, real self somewhere? What if that real self never existed? So this is a question we're going to try to approach during this hour. I'll give you just a third one before we take our break, and then we'll come back to you and go further with this and take your phone calls at 212-209-2900. So the question becomes, let's say that you're somebody who's an image-driven person, and all you care about is your image, how you appear to people, how you appear at your job mainly, how well you're doing your job, and image is very, very important to you, and how you look and all that stuff. What if an image-driven person gave up their image? Let's say it was a physical image. Let's say they wore no more makeup. Let's say they didn't do exercise for the sake of looking right. They may have do exercise for the sake of feeling right, but no longer the looking right part, not that the clothes should fit. What if they gave up wearing makeup? What if they gave up even brushing their hair a certain way other than clean? What if it stayed within the realm of the natural? But they let their armpits grow and the hair and the, you know, so on and so forth. Now you're giving up one of your major approaches to life, which is your image. Would that result in a healthier, better person? These are funny questions. It's hard to imagine somebody who is completely in a natural state being sound of mind. If I saw somebody in a completely natural state with hair that was just let to go anywhere it wanted to, no makeup and clothing that were just built for the way they felt, you know, and bare feet maybe or something like that, I would assume there's something wrong with the person just because I see this, even though it may be the most natural of all people. This is the conundrum. This is the question that therapists have to ask themselves. Because before we take people down the road of looking to their natural self, we have to ask further questions. We're going to continue this when we get back from our program, and we'll also take your calls at 212-209-2900. This is Armando Mill. We're going to take a short break. When we get back, a little music, and then we'll continue.
Very good.
Ooh.
That's Uplavu Zuru from Pink Martini's Hang On Little Tomato album. This is Armando Mill with you with Lisa Nannoni. Arnone, we are looking at the positive mind, and we're looking at some of the reasons that people go to make changes, you know, and whether or not these changes have any meaning whatsoever. So let's say that you say, I want to stop doing it. You know, I'm somebody who, there's a thing in drug rehabilitation, which they say, you know, you do the least amount of damage possible, that you do minimal amount of drugs and medication, and if you do the minimum, you're going to be okay. There are other people who say you got to do absolutely none, right? One is called harm reduction therapy. You ever hear that, Lisa? Harm reduction. Yeah, it was pioneered by Andrew Tatarsky, and it was like a very good idea that, okay, so you're not going to stop. Let's say you do the smallest amount possible to keep you going, and if we keep an eye on that, it should work. Mostly, people said, no, I've got to stop completely. So this idea of having to give up something completely. It's like if you want to go on a diet, you have to give up all sweets forever. It's like this idea in your mind. The mind doesn't like that too much. The mind doesn't like the idea that you're going to have to give up your favorite defense. So here we are looking at the different things, the different styles of life. One, for example, would be the romantic. Being a romantic and being somebody who is, this is the 4 in the Enneagram, artistic type, very, very artistic, beautifully artistic, the type that could create in their mind wonderful things, but highly dramatic. They always tend to be depressed, or they tend to be depressed. They see the cup as half empty as opposed to half full. They're on the negative side of things, and life feels difficult. They also have a very strong need to be unique, to be perceived uniquely and to be seen uniquely and not to be categorized with anyone else. So here's a person who is, you know, who is this artistic, creative self who's depressed. And they go to a therapist and they say, I want to get rid of my depression. And the whole thing of it, the whole piece of it is built around this being. That in this case, if you take the depression out of the formula and you say, well, you know, maybe you got to get a job, or, you know, maybe there's got to be some other path that you take. You remove all of it. Is that the right thing to do? People feel that sometimes they got to give up everything to make a small change. And sometimes we over-dramatize the amount of change that is necessary to get to a certain new place in life. 212-209-2900 is our number here, 212-209-2900. We're going to take your calls in just a minute, because this is about you. You know, it's about you and you're trying to get through. We have this huge question about an authentic self. The huge question is there such a thing as an authentic self? Is there something underneath everything that's real? If you take away all the unreal you, and we eliminate it, all the stuff that you do to get affection and caring from people, and we eliminate it, what would be left? Well, it's a good Buddhist question. You know, he's possessions, needing emotional, needing confirmation. I mean, this is kind of the Buddhist way. And if you pardon me, my dear Buddhist friends, I believe the answer is, if you remove it all, if you take away the possessions, and you take away the behaviors that are meant to mask the basic human suffering, which is what the belief is, that if you let yourself feel it, you rejoin this universe, this godly feeling, and that that's what it's about, and that the meditation and the quietness and the joining the universe is the payoff for giving up all earthly belongings as well as needs and passions. Very interesting concept. Very interesting concept. I've seen for some people it's a wonderful thing, and for other people they just get depressed.
Okay.
212-209-2900. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there. I know you're there. Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now.
Listening to, you know, your show, and, you know, I have a mother that's just, you know, to put it bluntly, like, everything about her, like, psyche and how she does is, like, a lie. And it's gotten progressively worse over the years. I mean, it came to a head with a car accident a few years ago when she was kind of faking an injury, thinking that she would get money from a settlement. And in that process, in the house, doesn't want to be seen. And, you know, my other sibling and I were just laughing at this whole charade. And my father was going along with it for a while, thinking the same thing. They would get, like, a settlement out of it, get money out of it. But they haven't, and he said, you know, I'm not going to do that anymore. And she continued to be that way, just faking an injury. And all of a sudden, this is kind of manifests into, like, oh, this hurts, that hurts, and so forth. And in any case, it's been a downward spiral over the last 6 years. And to talk to her, to get an honest answer, is next to impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Never know what's true, what's a lie, and she's just become, you know, it's just notorious. Like, listen, our trust is gone because I can't believe anything you say, because you say A, and you look around, and it's completely different. And, you know, I have no idea how to even begin to help.
No, right, and to help is a question. Let me ask you something. Do you think she knows the difference between truth and non-truth? Or do you think she actually believes?
I do think so.
You think she knows the difference? She's just lying on purpose.
Lying on purpose and, like, over stupid things. You know, and it's like, you know, and I, you know, we just learn to just, you know, just leave
to
it
roll
alone.
To roll your eyes, which is what you do.
Roll your eyes.
That's,
you know,
it. Roll your eyes when Mama's talking. I've seen enough people who have got parents like this, where the like, father or mother was like a pathological liar, and nobody believes anything.
Exactly.
Here's what's really wrong with it. Here's what's really wrong with it. What's your first name?
This is Ivan.
Ivan, you know what's really wrong with it? The real problem here, besides what she does and her behaviors, is that you have no idea if your mother cares for you or not.
Yeah, you know something? You know, I do believe in her heart of hearts that she does care, but the way she...
You know, Ivan, it becomes harder and harder to believe it when you see somebody living such a lie. And when you see it, because maybe she has disconnected from the ability to care for you, to really feel it, to love you. Maybe she's so invested in this false presentation. And this is the difficulty, you see, because if you guys had to face this and say, Mom can't love me anymore, and this happens a lot with people with Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
Mom can't love me anymore. You know, in Alzheimer's disease, very often a person doesn't even recognize their child.
Right.
And so the child goes there looking for affection. But no, you can't love me anymore. Now, when you, what I noticed with you is you said, nah, we know in our heart of hearts she really loves us. Maybe what you've got to do is step up to that reality and say, you know, in her heart of hearts she doesn't love anything right now, including us. How would I function then? How would I be different if I knew that she really no longer cares for me? She no longer puts me as a priority. And she cares more about her sham.
You know, some doctor, I've, like, my brother and I have made peace with that, like, a while ago. I mean, we all have children, and we're more concerned about, you know, her being in her grandchild's life. But being
very
that
difficult.
She's basically a mess, you know, it's like...
Very, very difficult to have her in your grandchildren's life.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is like the slow degradation of that family structure, but however, for me, I have to make sure I maintain, like, emotional and mental health and have my children, who I am responsible for, to be raised in a loving home. And, Mom, I'm sorry if you can't be a part of that because of whatever issues you're going through. Well, I have to, you know, love you from a distance, but I can't have any of what she's going through poison like my unit that's going on right here. So I love you to death. I want to help, but she's got to allow that to happen, and she's just not. Because even in therapy sessions, you can't even begin to make any headway if you're going to lie to the therapist. Like, come on.
Very, very difficult, Ivan, and letting go is a very difficult thing. I'm proud of you in the way that you've taken care of it, and I can see what you're doing with your family to try to keep your family immured. You don't want them necessarily to run into this contagion, but there's nothing you could do. Your children cannot be protected against your mother. Your children are going to have to grow up having had a crazy grandmother. You see, you can't protect them.
That's basically it.
Yeah, but you can't protect them. Your need to protect them, mind you, your need to protect them from the reality is akin to your mother's need to lie to you. You don't want to lie to your kids.
Wait, could you repeat that? I missed that.
Okay, your need to protect your children from the reality of mom's being nutty, you know, you need to shelter them, is very much like your mother's deciding to deceive. It's another deception. Does that mean you take your children and you say to them, look, mommy's crazy, look this? No, but you be very careful not to make excuses for your mother. You make very careful not to state anything that's a non-truth. You know, like, oh yeah, she forgot your birthday, but she really cares and she really called up and wished you happy birthday. Don't do anything that would in any way protect them from the awareness of what's going on.
I don't do that. I mean, they're, like, perceptive enough to see what's going on. And they do ask questions, and I just keep it simple. It's like, grandma's had, you know, some personal problems, and she's really dealing with that. Just, you know, say a prayer for her.
Well, I don't know. I would go a little further. I would go a little further. I would say grandma'd have some tough times, and sometimes she's really irritable, and she makes me angry too. And you don't have to say a prayer. You're willing to. It's okay if you get angry.
Yeah.
All right. I would take them there. Thank you.
I've gotten angry, but you know, Ivan.
Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor.
Sure. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. It's amazing how we, without even meaning to, sometimes perpetuate the very thing that we're fighting against the most. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Yes, this is Tony. I'm just going to run something quick by you.
Sure, Tony. Tony, could you speak a little louder?
Yeah, sure. I have the tendency to use my true and false name when meeting people. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Why do you do that?
Maybe it's because I think maybe some people, depending on how genuine they are in the initial reading, then I introduce myself as, you know, who I am. And other people, even people I've known for years, know me as someone else.
Mm-hmm. How do you like that? So you live an actual fraudulent life. You know what it says to me, Tony? It says to me that you never felt safe around your father. Talk to me about that.
Never felt safe around my father. That's an interesting. Never thought about that.
I know, but that's why I do the radio show and you listen.
Yeah. yeah, I love your shirt. It's great. I think I sometimes did and sometimes didn't.
And when you didn't, what was it?
When I didn't?
When you didn't feel safe around him.
I knew what his sort of a... his temper would be if he disagreed with
me. He had a strong temper.
Or if you challenged him in any way.
Mm-hmm. So if he saw you doing something that you wanted to do that was the real you, he may disagree with it, punish you, challenge it.
Yeah.
And so you learned to duck him. You learned to be evasive. And you've built a whole structure of evasiveness, which has to do with two identities.
Right.
Fascinating. You know, but it goes all the way back to the source. That the person you're protecting you against is no longer a danger to you.
I recently spoke to someone I hadn't seen in about 20 years.
Uh-huh.
She actually said the same thing. She was like, wow, always the same evasive person. And I was just like, excuse me? She's like, you know what I mean, just basically think back about it. And I was like, wow, she's right.
You know, it tells me something, though, about you. It tells me that you're ready to alter this. The very fact that you're talking about it on the air and the fact that you're talking about recognizing what you're doing with her says that you seem to be ready to let this go a little bit, to kind of put some holes in the cheese, you know, to kind of make it lighten up a little bit so that it's not, it's holes in the sails, isn't it? It's not
that's cheap. True. I have been thinking about that, yeah.
Yeah, it does sound like you're trying to do it a little bit. So that even on, I was curious, the name that you gave us, was that your real name or your other name?
No, that's partially my real name.
It's partially your real name.
Yes.
Because if you said your real name on the air, what would happen? What's the danger?
I guess there's no danger. I guess creating a sense of that there's no reason for that.
Maybe. Well, let's see what happens to you if you do it. Because if you do it, you know, a bolt of lightning may come down and strike you. I'm serious about this.
No, I doubt that.
But it's very possible. You never know, because there's some part of you that is saying, be careful, don't do it. And there's some part of you right now on the radio with me who wants to take on the challenge. So if you tell me your name, I'm going to say hello to you using your name back. Okay? Let's give it a try. Let's see what happens.
Well, Tony is my name.
Uh-huh.
It's just not my first name.
What's your first name?
That will have to remain with me.
So you don't want to do it?
Not on the radio, no.
No, because on the radio, if you do it, what would happen? What's the danger? You see what I mean? Here's what happens.
Out of my control. You know?
Yeah, here's what happens, exactly. What happens is we begin fighting battles that no longer exist. So it's certainly your choice. I don't need you to do anything other than what you're doing. But it would be interesting to see if even here you could make that leap.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good question. Part of me wants to do it, but I'm like, yeah, I haven't done it before, so why start now?
Exactly right. I understand completely, and you know what you're dealing with. Well, thank you very much for calling in.
Yes,
because, you know, some other guy would be pushing you and saying, oh, come on, Tony, you could do it this one time. Not me. I got respect for what people are and how they are.
Yeah. Well, that would never work with me anyway. So
never work with you, which is exactly why I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
Because there's a part of you that likes to resist.
Yes.
That likes to fight, that likes to push back.
Always.
Tony, thanks so much for calling.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Oh, it's great. It's great to see how solidly it sits. How solidly in there it sits. So that even if you considered the alternative, you default to this position, even if it's not a position you want to keep. Happens to us so much. This is Armand DeMille with Lisa Arnone. We are here with you with the Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, guests, talking to you about this authentic self that we're searching for, whether or not it's a valid search, and what it looks like when you find it. We will be continuing this discussion with you starting next week, next Tuesday, at 1 p.m. It is fine and wonderful and brilliant and great to be able to share this space with you again. Lisa, thank you for all the research, even though I know you weren't saying very much today. The work that you did with me to get this together was very valuable.
Oh, you're welcome, and it was just great to listen.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for calling in. So, be back with you, my friends, next Tuesday at 1 p.m. You can get the archives on thepositivemind.com or on WBAI.org.
Wonderful morning, such a sky you never did see.
Who will call me in the studio, please, Armand? Call me in the studio.
Get up with a ribbon and put it in a box for me. and bad, so I can see it at my leisure whenever things go wrong, and I would keep it as a treasure to last my whole life long. Ooh. Wonderful feeling, I'm so high, I swear I could fly. Me, oh my, I don't want to lose it. So what am I to do to keep the sky so blue? There must be someone who will buy.
Sweet stuff. Thank you so much, Armand.